Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama has called for 1 million plug-in cars on U.S. roads by the year 2015. Electric vehicles, or EVs, are already being tested across the country. The first ones will be available for purchase by the end of the year. For this month's Environmental Outlook series, the state of the new EVs, how they might change our roads, and our dependency on oil. Joining us in the studio, David Shepherdson of the Detroit News and Dave Goldstein of the Electric Vehicle Association of Greater Washington, D.C. Joining us by phone from Austin, Texas, is Robert Bryce of Energy Tribune. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments on electric vehicles. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet. Join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you. Dave Goldstein, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Diane. It's really a pleasure.
David Shepherdson, good to see you again.
Good morning, Diane.
And Robert Bryce, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Glad to have you all with us. Dave Goldstein, what are these new electric cars coming out?
Well, every manufacturer in the world has been working on electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles of one type or another. They've all made major announcements about their plans for the next 2 to 3 years. And I think leading the pack is probably the Nissan Leaf and the General Motors plug-in hybrid electric vehicle called the Volt. And there's a tremendous amount of anticipation here in the U.S. for these cars, as well as in Europe, where these cars are also being offered. So I think there's quite a plan here to start mass production to the point that we can get the prices down and the anticipation of these cars can be met.
Now, I have to ask you, Dave, because I know you worked on the film Who Killed the Electric Car, which I watched twice yesterday. What is the difference between now and back then when the electric car died?
Well, I think in the 1990s, when the electric vehicles were forced on manufacturers by the state of California, there was tremendous resistance. Automotive manufacturers are, of course, they have benzene in their blood, I think, and they don't really want to take that risk. They see it as a fundamental change in the type of manufacturing that they would have to do, and they don't necessarily see a profit for a long time to come, so they see nothing but risk and cost. And I think they, of course, railed against any sort of government regulation, and they fought that bill to the teeth with probably about $600 million, I think was the figure that I've seen, to kill the electric car. Now, today, that's all changed with $4 gasoline and the tremendous spilling of oil in the Gulf and a growing environmental awareness and concern about global warming, and the entire dissolution of the American automobile industry, practically. General Motors, of course, made a very serious mistake killing the EV1. They actually had one of the most advanced cars in the world when they built that car.
It was gorgeous, as a matter of fact. David Shepherdson, what are the incentives now for these cars?
There's a huge number of incentives. I mean, number one, the government is spending billions of dollars to subsidize and develop the research for these vehicles. There's also a $7,500 tax credit for the purchase of an EV. And in states like California and Colorado, there's up to a $5,000 or $6,000 state tax credit. But more than that, it's about the image of companies. I mean, GM's former CEO has said the single biggest mistake they made was killing the EV1. Not because they lost a lot of money in lost sales. They only sold 1,100 EVs over 3 years. But it was about the fact that they allowed Toyota to grab the mantle of the environmental company. And with the Prius, although Toyota only sold 1 million Priuses in 10 years, Toyota, became the green company. And as a result, people considered Toyotas. that didn't necessarily buy a Prius but bought another fuel-efficient Toyota. So I think GM and Nissan, and frankly, as Dave pointed out, almost every company in the next few years, not to mention the startups like Tesla and Fisker, are going to be in this market, and you're going to have to be in the electric vehicle market to show that you're with it as an auto company.
Didn't GM actually discourage the sale of that EV1?
Well, they certainly, I mean, made a lot of mistakes. They crushed the vehicles afterward, which was just a political, it was a disaster.
It was a disaster. I mean, watching that was just heart-wrenching.
In their defense, they would have been required to maintain the parts and service if those vehicles had been on the road, and they did lease them, not sell them. But in the minds of consumers, to take perfectly good vehicles off the roads, you know, was a big mistake that the company has acknowledged. And as a result, you know, they...
Of course, they had help from the oil companies as well, didn't they, Dave Goldstein?
Absolutely. There was a what they called a green turf movement in California during the 90s, and a coalition of supposedly honest citizens who didn't want to see their money wasted on this vile technology. Of course, they were funded by the oil industry. A group called WESPA, the Western States Petroleum Association, was one of the prime players in the efforts to kill the electric car in the 1990s. But by the way, I drove an EV1. Several times along California and Malibu. And
was it gorgeous?
It was absolutely amazing. Yeah. It's like driving a jet aircraft on the road. It was so pleasant to drive that car. I can't describe to you my feelings when they began crushing them.
All right. Robert Bryce, Dave Goldstein talked about the Chevy Volt, the Nissan Leaf. Mercedes has one. Mitsubishi has one. There's a smart car that is introducing 250 EVs in the U.S. for lease only in October and then rolling out in 212. How much are they going to cost?
Well, the answer is too much. this is a niche of a niche market. And you can ask any of the automakers about this, and that's what they will tell you. And I think Mr. Shepherdson hit it right, that a lot of this for these companies is PR. The fact is that the electric car industry, for all of the positive press it gets, it has a century-long history of failure, tailgating failure. Here's a clip from the New York Times in 1911. The electric car has long been recognized as the ideal solution because it is cleaner and quieter and much more economical. The Washington Post, 1915, prices on electric cars will continue to drop until they're within reach of the average family. Washington Post, 1979, General Motors has found a breakthrough in batteries that will provide the 100-mile range GM executives believe is necessary to successfully sell electric vehicles to the public. The fact is, the government is now picking technology winners, and they've chosen electric cars just like they've chosen corn ethanol, and we've seen what's happened with corn ethanol.
David Shepherdson?
Well, Robert's certainly right that the government is making a major bet on electric vehicles, and I think the question is, what's the definition of success? I mean, certainly in the short term, electric vehicles are going to be a very small part of the market. Even by the most optimistic estimates, by 2020, there'll only be 10% of the market. It's certainly true that in the short term, the only way electric vehicles are going to get off the ground is through government subsidies, both of the purchase, the research, and the production of these vehicles. I mean, the Obama administration spent $2.4 billion in cash grants giving this money to auto companies and battery companies last August, that money that doesn't have to be paid back to make electric vehicles a reality. But we certainly also subsidized nuclear power, the oil industry. I mean, by some estimates, we're giving $4 billion in tax incentives to oil. So this is just the latest in a series of efforts to try to diversify energy use.
Dave Goldstein.
My view is that you have to start somewhere, Diane. You start with a new technology that's very much like the first flat-screen TVs, or the first iPods or iPads, or the first smartphones. They're expensive initially, but people line up to buy them, and eventually the price drops. Now, I was fortunate to work on advanced batteries with the U.S. Department of Energy's ad hoc Advanced Battery Readiness Working Group for 10 years. And we saw the steady development of these batteries and the cost beginning to drop. We know that right now the batteries that are used, these lithium-ion batteries, are very advanced. They are cost-effective over about a 10-year period. And we also know that they're safe and reliable, and that we can bring the cost down by almost a factor of four if we can get these cars in mass production.
So now I understand right now the Leaf will come out with a sticker price of $32,780, ranging up to the base price of a Tesla electric car, $110,000. Why is that so expensive, Dave?
Well, we're talking about almost a hand-built vehicle. Anytime you build a vehicle in limited numbers by hand, it's going to be expensive. A Ferrari, for example, is also about $160,000.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
or
higher. I think there's a $200,000 Ferrari now. These are hand-built vehicles. Now, the Tesla is actually faster than a Ferrari, but it is basically a hand-built car right now, and we have to get that into mass production to bring the cost down. There is already plans for a Model S Tesla, which is a sedan that will be in the $50,000 range. And that will compete with the upper-end market for cars like the BMW 750, the Lexus vehicles, et cetera. And I think it will succeed.
But I do think there's an interesting question that should the government be subsidizing the purchase of vehicles for the very rich? I mean, as you point out, the people who are going to buy the Tesla are people who might otherwise buy a BMW. And the government has given Tesla and Fisker about $1 billion in low-cost government loans to mass produce these vehicles.
But didn't they do the same thing when you had this little electric EV1 that got something like a $2,000 credit, whereas you got the Hummer with a $100,000 credit?
You're talking about there was a tax break in a budget bill about,
yeah,
that basically allowed people who were small business people to write off the cost of the Hummer because it was a mobile office, and it was eventually that got repealed, but there's certainly lots of examples of subsidizing SUVs.
I do want to let listeners know you can find pictures of the electric smart car, the Nissan Leaf, and the Chevy Volt on our website at drshow.org. And we're back talking about exciting developments in the growth and production and perhaps appearance on the roads of an all-electric vehicle. David Shepardson of the Detroit News is here in the studio, as is Dave Goldstein. He's president of the Electric Vehicle Association of Greater Washington, D.C. On the line with us is Robert Bryce, managing editor of the Energy Tribune. He's author of Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. I hope you'll join us. Calls, emails, your comments on Facebook, send us a tweet. Here's an email from Kevin in Baltimore, who says, I like the idea of clean running electric cars, anything to get off oil. However, if we're all plugging in to get our cars charged, the obvious question is, what is the source of electricity? Is it from coal? If it is, then we'll increase our air pollution. If the source is solar, then full speed ahead. David Shepardson.
Well, I was at an energy conference a year ago where someone made the point that if you plug in a Nissan Leaf or a Chevy Volt in West Virginia, where about 98% of the power comes from coal, your net emissions would be twice as high driving an electric vehicle than they would be filling up on gasoline. So if your goal is to reduce carbon emissions, you know, unless you do something about the source of electricity, you know, you're not going to solve the problem.
All right. And joining us now is David Sandilo. He's Assistant Secretary in the Department of Energy. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
Thanks for joining us. Talk about what kinds of pressures these cars could put on the electric grid.
Oh, the good news is that they will put minimal pressures on the electric grid. We could put tens of millions of cars on the road that drive on electricity without significantly adding to electricity generation around the country. Electric cars are very efficient, and in particular, when they charge in at night, when electricity loads are low, they actually can improve the management of the grid in some places. It's what utility executives call load leveling. But, you know, big picture, Diane, these cars, electric cars, are the future. The only question is how soon. They're quiet. They're cheap to drive. They have great pickup. They're coming. And it's exciting to see companies like GM and Nissan bring the first mass-produced products out this fall.
And, of course, the government is spending billions of dollars on this. Talk about where that money is going.
It's been a wide range of investments around this country that's creating jobs in dozens of states. Under the Recovery Act, we're spending more than $5 billion on electric vehicle technology creating factories that are going to build batteries, build components, supporting the final assembly of these vehicles, and also doing advanced research. A key point here, governments around the world are doing this and more. This technology is coming. Electric vehicles are the future. I've been to China recently, and in China, they are investing extremely heavily in electric vehicles. The question is, will the United States be in a leadership position in this market?
What about charging stations?
Charging station. Most people will probably charge their cars at home. They'll plug in their garage. They'll recharge perhaps at work, and then in addition, there'll probably be public charging stations at different places in different cities. We're with federal funding supporting pilot projects to create these public charging stations in about 13 or 14 cities, and other cities around the country are starting to do this too. But we think most people will probably charge their cars at home, at least initially.
Now, I happen to live in a condominium. Are you suggesting that organizations like mine will establish those in the garage as well?
That's what most experts project. It's not expensive in the scheme of things to be running wiring down into garages and putting outlets in. It's certainly a lot cheaper than some of the different types of vehicle technologies people are talking, like kind of hydrogen pipes or that type of thing. So it's likely that that people will be able to recharge in the garages of their condos and apartment buildings in the years ahead as these vehicles start rolling off the production lines.
I gather you drive a plug-in hybrid yourself.
I do, and it is so much fun. I'll tell you, I get on average, depending on the kind of driving patterns, around 80 miles a gallon or more in my plug-in hybrid vehicle. I've got this sensitive gauge that will sometimes, it shows mileage up to over 1,000 miles a gallon. And sometimes if I'm driving along, it'll show 999 miles a gallon as I drive along, which is very satisfying.
Now, finally.
Diane, can I jump in here a minute? Because, look, I understand all the hype over electric cars, but the problem here is basic physics. I mean, in addition to the infrastructure challenge of finding the recharging stations or the time to charge these vehicles, which is extraordinarily long, particularly when compared to refueling a gasoline engine, the problem is basic physics. Gasoline has 80 times the energy density of the best lithium-ion batteries. So consumers are concerned about this. If you look at a recent poll that was done by Harris Interactive, they found that just 2% of consumers, of vehicle owners, were interested in buying electric cars. This is a niche of a niche. And for Mr. Sandalo to say, oh, these are the future, gasoline-powered, diesel-powered vehicles are with us, and they're going to be with us for a long time to come.
All right. I want to have Dave Goldstein address one of those issues.
Well, I've got to agree with Robert that physics is a major part of this issue, but I think he's got his physics a little bit wrong. First of all, the electric vehicle uses far less energy than a gasoline motor. The gasoline motor, which has all of this available energy, basically uses only about 15 to 20% of that energy, depending on how much it idles in traffic. About 80% of the energy basically goes out the tailpipe and the radiator, so it's wasted energy, which we can no longer afford in this age of global warming. We have to do something better than that. In fact, we're looking at an oil future that is very worrisome. There's no turning back. We have to use this technology in order to gain the advantage.
David
Goldstein is exactly right. And if I could,
sure.
Physics has been raised to invoke my boss, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics. And I can tell you he is very enthusiastic about this technology. He's made some of the key decisions to fund this at a very significant level for our country. So I think from a physics standpoint, we're doing pretty well with these cars for the reasons David Goldstein was just pointing to.
Oh, David Shepperton.
David, can I ask you, one of the reasons that Tesla and Fisker are moving ahead with mass manufacturing and starting in 2012 is because of government loans. There's about $16 billion left in this vehicle low-cost loan program. Can you give us a sense of when we might see additional loans coming from that program?
Obviously, I can't comment on any particular loan application or loans in process, but these are programs which have tremendous opportunity to support American development of this technology. And I think that is what I hope listeners will really take away from this, that we've got federal government programs right now that can help us get in the lead and stay in the lead in developing this technology, which is going to be so important globally. I'd like to read a quote from, I'm a Democrat, I work for President Obama. I'd like to quote a Republican senator on this, Senator Lamar Alexander, who said Republicans and Democrats agree that electrifying our cars and trucks is the single best way to reduce our dependence on oil. It's just such a key factor. This is something that, in this town where we're fighting about so much, it's something that we can and we are coming together on to help get Americans off their dependence on foreign oil, invest in a technology of the future.
So you've got this Electric Drive Vehicle Deployment Act, which I gather has this goal to electrify half of all cars and trucks on U.S. roads by 2030. Can you meet that goal, do you believe?
Yeah, I think half of the new cars coming off in 2030 can be electric cars. We're on a road towards a transformation in technology, but the pace of that transformation is going to depend upon the support that we provide it.
Diane, can I jump in here for a minute?
Sure, go ahead.
There are huge constraints here in terms of any turnover of the automotive fleet. As Mr. Shepardson said earlier, it took Toyota 10 years to sell 1 million copies of the Prius. There are 250 million motor vehicles in the United States. So if we're talking about having half of new cars sold in 2030 be electric, we're talking then, what, maybe 5 million vehicles a year? We're talking about enormous subsidies then that are going to be required to make this kind of a move. And that's one point. Der Spiegel had an article just a few weeks ago saying that over the next 5 years, the U.S. is going to provide $27 billion in subsidies for electric car production and development, while France is only spending one-tenth that much and Germany spending less than $1 billion. The other constraint here is one that isn't talked about a lot, and that is the availability of rare earth elements. So this idea that we're going to get rid of our oil dependency, which I think is wrong, we will likely then, in this headlong rush for hybrid vehicles or electric vehicles, switch to a dependency on Chinese-sourced lanthanides, the elements like neodymium, lanthanum, that are essential commodities in the production of these vehicles.
All right. Dave Goldstein wants to comment.
Robert, I was fortunate to chair a committee on that at the recent TREM conference, which is the technology on rare earth materials. And the good news about rare earths is that they aren't really rare. I mean, they're rare on the periodic chart.
What are you talking about?
These are about 10 or 12 special metals that are keys not only to the magnetic parts of the electric motors and to wind turbines, but they are also involved in things like your computer screens, your CFLs, your compact fluorescent lights, missiles, aerospace turbines. All of these things are vital. And Robert's right. China controls about 95% of the market. However, I think he's underestimating the resiliency of the American economy. We have rare earth materials here in the United States. There are rare earth materials in Canada and across the globe. And it's a matter of gearing up to create enough rare earths to meet the demand. And we are going to do that.
Secretary Santillo, let me ask you one further question. And that is, aren't you, by virtue of moving forward on the electric vehicle with such intensity, aren't you going to put a lot of gasoline-powered automobile parts manufacturers out of business?
No, Diane, I don't see that happening at all. I think we are going to make a transition to create additional jobs. I come from Michigan, and I have seen the devastation of Michigan's economy over the course of the past several decades as a result of not meeting market expectations and demands. I think what this technology offers us the potential to do is to invest in the technology of the future to create jobs in places where they've been lost. And in fact, that's already happening. We've already turned plants that had gone quiet as a result of market forces into productive plants, creating jobs for Americans using funds on this technology. And I see a lot more of that coming down the road.
All right. And finally, I think Dave Shepherdson wants to ask.
No. Well, just to David's point, in fact, the administration has given both loans and grants to auto parts producers like Delphi to help them diversify into electric vehicle programs. And in fact, his boss, the president, on Thursday is going to be visiting in Kansas City, Smith Electric Vehicles, one of those companies, those startups that has received a $32 million grant under the stimulus program to build heavy-duty electric trucks.
All right. And Assistant Secretary in the Department of Energy, David Santillo, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers on the line. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Diane. When I was in sixth grade, we took an iron nail, wrapped copper wire around it, and then drug a magnet across it, and we created electricity. That's how generators work. Now, we can do the same thing with something that we've created called perpetual motion, and that is traffic. Traffic is perpetual motion. If we put iron bars in the interstate highway system that are wrapped with copper wire, and then every car having magnets in it would generate electricity, we could use that electricity to offset the coal that we're using to burn in power plants.
What do you think, Dave Goldstein? Have you heard that theory before?
Yes, I have. I've seen some of the studies that have been done on these magnetic placements in the road and various other types of inductive power. The best way to use the inductive power is really for mass transit and vehicles that are parked, and they park on an inductive pad, and the vehicle can be charged inductively. So that is, he's on the right track, but it's extremely expensive to do this on the highway. And by the way, there's no such thing as perpetual motion. We've been trying to invent that for the last couple of centuries, I believe, and we haven't quite gotten there yet.
All right, let's go to Francisco in Miami, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning. What I wanted to say was that the main problem with this is that most cars, most hybrids at least, or most electric cars are expensive. Coming from a 17-year-old college student, I don't want to give up the power I have from a gasoline engine to go into a hybrid or electric car. The other thing is that Bolivia has the biggest lithium mine in the world, and they're landlocked. So the cost to move all that rare earth that you were talking about before is ridiculous. So it would pretty much drive up the cost of the cars.
Do you believe that, Dave Shepperton?
Well, certainly the cost is a major factor. And I think right now, and especially when you consider the current price of gasoline, and it is difficult for people to have to spend a significant price premium, potentially $10,000, $20,000, in the case of the Tesla, possibly $30,000 more than a similar gasoline engine. But in the long term, for example, the Chevy Volt, they talk about 2 cents a mile on electric power versus 12 cents a mile on gasoline. And I think the other issue is just the uncertainty about gasoline prices. We don't know where they're going, but certainly now it's cheaper on gasoline than electric power.
David Shepperton, he's a Washington bureau chief of the Detroit News. Robert Bryce, when we come back, I promise you'll have your chance to come. And in the meantime, give us a call, join us on Facebook, send us a tweet.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
In her new Emily Dickinson biography, Lives Like Loaded Guns, Lyndall Gordon speculates that the reclusive poet was epileptic. Gordon also describes how Dickinson's married brother's affair created a family feud over the poet's posthumous publication and her legacy. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Gordon and former poet laureate Billy Collins reads his favorite Dickinson poems. Join us.
And here's a message on Facebook from Cody, who says, the biggest problem I see is that cars aren't ready for a cross-country trip. I cannot justify the investment as something that would only be useful as a commuter, which is a shame. Dave Goldstein.
Well, I think you're thinking about cars as they exist today. We have, of course, the Tesla, which is good for up to 250 miles on a charge. That has a fairly large lithium-ion battery pack. We also have fast charging stations in the works. So in actuality, you could, if these stations were set up on major interstates, travel across the country, stop off for, let's say, a bite to eat or a cup of coffee. Your vehicle will be charged up in about 10 minutes or so, and then off you would go. Now, that's a possibility, but I think most likely we're going to see these cars used in urban environments where you have most of your driving is in the urban environment or the suburbs, and you have multiple cars in your household, which is very typical of the American family today.
Two quick points. One, Department of Energy says about 75% of all commuters go less than 40 miles per day, which would mean they would not need almost all the time to use the longer range. But the other issue, though, is the range and the fact that depending on conditions, it's very hot today in Washington. you wouldn't get that 40 or 100-mile range because of the demand for air conditioning. You'd be far less. So there, you know, that's an uncertainty issue that has to be dealt with.
All right. And, Brian, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Shepardson mentioned earlier the price of gasoline, which is the key, the key variable here. But I go back to my earlier point. Why is the government picking a technology winner here? The government is making huge subsidies in the world's most competitive industry and saying the electric car is the technology we want. Why not diesel vehicles? Why not compressed natural gas vehicles? I looked at this Harris Interactive poll that I referenced earlier. They surveyed several thousand adults, and the percentage of adults who said they were extremely likely to buy a pure electric car was 1%. Compare that to the ones who said they would be extremely likely to buy a diesel or a compressed natural gas engine.
All right.
4%.
Okay.
But on your diesel point, look at Europe. Why does Europe have about 50% of the market as diesel vehicles? Because of tax policy, because they heavily tax gasoline. So one way or the other, governments are having a big hand in determining the vehicles that the people drive.
All right. Here's another email. This from Brian, who's in Ypsilanti, Michigan. He says, plugging in at home is not as feasible as your guests make it sound. Much of the neighborhood transformer technology is ill-equipped to handle a huge increase in load from EVs. Current EV chargers take about 8 hours to fully charge. An alternative is to place solar-powered carports at places where people will be parked for 8 hours, such as offices, schools, airports. Dave Goldstein.
Well, first of all, I think they're underestimating the efficiency of the electric car. The amount of energy used to recharge an electric car is really relatively small. We're talking about effectively maybe a couple of light bulbs worth of energy to charge the plug-in hybrid at night.
Why does it take 8 hours?
We're talking about the amount of energy you can get out of a regular wall plug at 115 volts is only about 1 kilowatt hour, which is, you know, if you have a car that's, say, 30 kilowatt hours, obviously it takes a while. So you want to charge on 230. But even so, there's more than adequate nighttime energy available to do this. Using existing transformer technology, it's not a problem at night. In fact, the utilities actually want more electric cars at night to fill in that huge gap when power plants are just idling at very low efficiency, and that thereby increase the efficiency. But there's another element here. Solar power, renewable energy, is one of the natural things that fits together so nicely with electric cars. Electric cars are basically the only technology that can directly use renewable energy. You can use wind, you can use solar, and more people that we've seen that have electric cars today are demanding solar for their house, or they're buying wind energy. So I think we're going to see, a double premium here. Not only are we going to save oil, but we're going to save energy, and we're going to save the environment.
All right, to Charles, who's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
There's one critical argument I don't think people are discussing, and that is, in nature, there's such a thing as a carbon cycle. And I think by the time, you know, this huge, fantastic change in infrastructure to support the quadrillions of BTUs required to run a transportation sector on batteries, you're going to create something called a heavy metal cycle. And there's going to be so much heavy metal pollution, so much heavy metal mining pollution, that it's going to be another significant cost that'll have probably as many risks associated with it.
All right. I'm sure we have differing opinions here. David Goldstein, you first.
Let's compare that to all the oil that's floating in the Gulf of Mexico right now, the number of oil spills that occur annually, and the amount of energy that's wasted refining oil into gasoline or diesel. A lot of that comes from either the oil or from electricity. So we're not talking about a major change here in energy. We're not worried about the quadrillions because we have that adequate, as David just pointed out earlier, we have adequate nighttime capacity to fuel a vast market of electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles.
David?
I mean, there's certainly going to be impacts of additional heavy metal mining, to be certain. But if you look at the aggregate impact of the U.S. Spending, you know, upwards of $300 billion a year on imported oil, and the instability in the Middle East, and our military costs. I mean, the aggregate costs of the United States using so much oil is potentially $1 trillion a year.
Robert Bryce.
Well, the life cycle question here really is interesting, and it goes to the heart of the whether electric cars make sense or not. The National Academy of Sciences did an analysis last year on this very issue, and I reprint this figure in my book Power Hungry, but they show that electric cars in today and in 2030 will have what they call higher total life cycle damages than either conventional gasoline vehicles, compressed natural gas vehicles, or diesel vehicles. So, of course, it's all in the accounting, right? What is considered a cost and what is not? But I think that we have to be real careful when we talk about whether it's heavy metals or CO2 emissions, whether indeed electric vehicles are the environmental boon that they claim they are.
All right. To Gainesville, Florida. David, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I'm so happy to be on the show.
Good.
You know, I was just thinking about that stat that one of your guests had talked about, that 2% of Americans would buy an electric car. I mean, I'm just really curious as to what that actually means. Does it mean at this point, at 100 grand, they don't want to spend the money? That fully makes sense. So I guess my general comment and question revolves around the perception of this revolution of the electric car and, you know, how we can try and make the consumers aware of what these things mean.
Dave Goldstein.
In the United States, we sell anywhere from 10 to 17 million cars annually. So you can do the math here about 2%. But the problem here is that the 2% surveys were basically asking people who have a mindset towards gasoline already. So you really can't trust these kinds of numbers. Now, we do know that with hybrids so far, we're about 3% of the market. And that's going to change as the price of gasoline goes up, and it will go up. It's going to take perhaps another hurricane in the Gulf or a war in the Middle East. There will be some kind of a tipping point. $4 gas will look like a bargain when we see this, and I think you're going to see consumer attitudes change dramatically.
But the 2% figure is instructive in one sense, that in the first couple of years, maybe 5 years, we're not going to see a huge number of electric vehicles. I mean, GM says about 10,000 Chevy Volts next year. Nissan's going to sell 50,000 Leafs worldwide, so maybe a third to a half of those are in the U.S. You know, Ford expects to sell up to 10,000.
Don't you think
next year
people will want to see what that first rollout looks like before they're willing to take that chance?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You get the early adopters, and they're on the block, and people want to see them, or your
sure
friend or relative has one. And then, as Dave points out, if the price of gasoline continues to rise, then people say, well, I got to get out of my SUV and do whatever it takes to buy an electric vehicle.
Robert Bryce, you're pessimistic.
Well, look, I mean, I like to think that I'm a realist rather than a pessimist, but nevertheless, look, the key variable here is the price of gasoline. If we have $6 gasoline, and there have been numerous studies, Duke University did one on plug-in hybrid electrics, if the price of gasoline is $6, $7,
yep,
then absolutely the electric car market could take off. There's no question about it. Predicting oil prices is a fool's game, and I'm not about to.
All right. Okay, let's go to Ocean Pines, Maryland. And Donald, I'll bet you're listening on our new signal down there in Ocean City.
Thank you, Diane Ream. It's really an honor to talk to you and to your group. I owned a Prius for 6.5 years, and it only depreciated $16,000 during that 6.5 years. So my savings in gas actually didn't equate to I can put 49,000 miles on the car. And right now I have a new Impala, and it's doing fairly decent. But I think the key is that Prius engine was developed by the University of Maryland. And when Toyota took it over, I think General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler could have easily acquired the same thing. So we're a little behind the schedule, but maybe the key is having a hybrid, because the area that we live in, the electric was local for shopping, but to visit our grandchildren 2.5 hours away and then expect to be able to get charged up either in route or after we get there, They've got a lot of doing to do to get the fast charging stations up. And I have no objection to driving an electric vehicle, but one thing they should be aware of, that they are noiseless, and the pedestrians will have to be aware that there's noiseless vehicles out there.
Yes, indeed. Go ahead, David.
Sure. A couple quick points. To the point about noiseless vehicles, there's actually a voluntary agreement among auto companies and the blind advocates to require in the next couple of years sounds at stops and starts for plug-in hybrids to alert pedestrians. On the Prius pricing, the CEO of AutoNation pointed out that at $450 a gallon, a one-year-old Prius was selling for $25,000. When the price fell to $350, it fell to $20,000. And today, at under $3, that same vehicle sells for $15,000. So, so much of the demand is directly tied to gasoline prices.
But going back to the who killed the electric car, it would seem that there was a direct disincentive from the automobile manufacturer GM to consumers to buy that car, Dave Goldstein.
Well, they made it very, very difficult. You could only get the car in California, by the way, and there were a couple of dealers in Arizona. And General Motors got calls and letters from all across the country.
Begging.
Yeah, big begging. They only built about 1,100 of these cars, only leased about 850, three times over, had a three-year waiting list. General Motors did not want to be in the electric car business.
Why not?
They saw it as a risk, a big risk for them. They didn't see the profit coming out of it. When you have an electric car, you don't have a vehicle that really comes in for a lot of service at the dealer. You don't have the parts and service, which are two of the very important profit centers for the automotive industry. Although there are other elements. I mean, cars still are going to require windshield wipers and headlight replacements
of
and
course.
Tires and so forth.
And what about the petroleum industry?
Well, they don't. They didn't like it then, but I think as we look to the future and realize that we're going to have to go out further and further into deep water drilling to create enough oil to try to meet our demand, probably fruitlessly because the world demand is rising beyond the discovery of new oil, I think we're going to find that we're going to have electric cars.
Dave Goldstein of the Electric Vehicle Association of Greater Washington. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about the Dodge Challengers. I have a 72, and I was wondering if there were any plans in converting them to, electric, because it doesn't seem like that I can get all the parts that I need now anyway.
I mean, there are conversion kits out on the market, especially for the Toyota Prius. I don't know if that vehicle, if you could convert it, but it's certainly worth looking into.
What do you think, Dave?
Well, in the Electric Vehicle Association, we have a number of people that have converted gasoline cars to electricity. And as David just pointed out, there are kits available. There are parts available from suppliers throughout the U.S. And, yes, you can convert your Dodge Challenger if you really want to. It's going to cost you a lot of time and probably a lot of money. And, of course, the battery pack would probably be an old-fashioned lead pack because you can't get those lithium-ion batteries.
Oh, I see.
Unless you get them from China, by the way, and some of our people are doing that.
Why don't you give John your email address or your website so that he can get in touch?
Sure. Check out www.evadc.org or the Electric Auto Association, which is a nationwide group at EAAEV.org.
There you go. And finally, to Alvin in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, everyone. I just make a couple of quick comments. It seems to me that electric cars are going to be a lot more practical when we actually build light vehicles made out of composite thermoplastics like Amory Lovins has done with his hypercar at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado. And you really should have him on your show, Dan. But anyway, he's able to build a car with 14 body panels that weighs 1,000 to 1,200 pounds, which reduces the size of the battery, reduces the size of the internal combustion engine, reduces the size of the fuel cell, and makes it practical to conserve energy when you reduce the weight of a vehicle. And
Go ahead, David.
He's absolutely right on the physics. The lighter the car, the longer the range. There's just one problem. You've got federal safety standards, and you have a lot of very heavy SUVs and trucks on the roads, and you can't just downweight vehicles without, you know, ensuring that they are strong enough. There's certainly ultra-strength lightweight materials that are coming. That'll be a big part of meeting fuel economy standards, but that's not the only answer.
Are we going to end up with each family having two cars, one for in the city, one for on the road, or will we eventually be able to use an electric car everywhere? Dave Goldstein.
I think that there are probably 50 different characteristics for different car buyers. Everybody has a unique taste. You might want to have an SUV that's electric or plug-in hybrid. But what you're going to see now, I think, are cars that can switch fuels, as they do in Brazil, for example, where you can buy either ethanol or gasoline, depending upon the individual cost on any given day. We're going to have cars that run on as hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and use alternative fuels as well. It's got to happen.
Dave Goldstein of the Greater Washington Electric Vehicle Association. David Shepherdson, he's Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. Robert Bryce is Managing Editor of Energy Tribune. Thank you all so much. I look forward to riding an electric vehicle before long. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.